Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
First, I suppose I should do a little shout-out. Father's Day today. Two men. 93% of the workplace deaths occur to men doing dangerous work. 98% of the deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan have occurred to men. Men die 5 years earlier of all diseases, and we all know stress is a major source of illness and death. And so for you men out there and fathers who try to be good fathers at the same time as you're bringing home the bacon, not that some women don't bring home the bacon, special shout out to you here on Father's Day. You know, there's a tremendous amount of attention that is paid to the have-nots in society. But of course, we all know that if we really think honestly about it, the greatest contributions to our life, whether it be the birth control pill that we use to control over or control when, if and when we want to have children, to the iPhone that we've become so addicted to, to leaders who create. Just did my laundry, and I'm amazed that I bought some basic Whirlpool washer and dryer, and it's now 20 years later, and it still runs well. Of course, some of the credit must go to the workers who do a good job of assembling them, although we live in a more robot-centric manufacturing world. But also the leaders who figure it all out, who develop a plan, who hire the right people, who develop the machines, who create budgets and plans and get these very heavy items called washing machines distributed so that even the poor among us can afford a washer and dryer generally, or at least can afford at a reasonable price to go to the laundromat and for a few bucks get our laundry done. So I thought for once I would do a segment on people who are bright in the workplace. I mean, we tend to think that it's intelligence is all good. After all, it does enable you to learn more quickly, and problem solve more complexly, remember more vividly. But there are burdens of intelligence, burdens of being intelligent. That's what I want to talk about, especially because the show's focused on the workplace. I want to focus just on that. In a workplace, by definition, not everybody is above average, just like height and weight, all kinds of attributes, introversion, extroversion. There's a wide range of people. And in that heterogeneous environment, it's very difficult very often for the intelligent person to not only not be rewarded, sometimes he or she gets rewarded for his intelligence, but certainly it's not all positive, and I like to talk about that which is not obvious. I suspect that you, my dear listener, recognizes this. If you are a bright person in a workplace that's heterogeneous in workers' ability, you're in a catch-22. If you show your intelligence all the time, you're easily going to be viewed as a know-it-all. And people may try to sabotage you. They do that all the time in the workplace. They do that even around looks. Somebody who's too attractive, somehow the other people find a way to try to sabotage them. It's certainly true of intelligence. But on the other hand, if you hold back, you're being less than you otherwise could be. Can you imagine people telling Steph Curry to not give his best because others might be jealous? Or Barbra Streisand to not sing so well because it might discourage lesser singers? First, I think I do need to say another word about this. We live in such an egalitarian era that there's something almost, you're not supposed to feel okay about being intelligent. We're all supposed to be kind of equal. Is it okay to think of yourself as smarter than others? We're made to feel guilty. We're made to feel good. Not forget about me. Other people, or people who are bright, are made to feel guilty for being so-called, quote, privileged, as though privilege was all unearned. There are many people who grew up poor who, because of their intelligence, not only succeeded, but gave so much to the world. And intelligence is, and really all the unbiased studies show that intelligence, the ability that is to reason, abstract, analyze, synthesize, put together multiple pieces of disparate data into interesting solutions, your intelligence is a powerful attribute. It can be a force for good, even great good. So I think we need to honor our strengths. If yours is intelligence, realize it is a gift that is, yes, environment enhances it, no question, but some of it's genetic, like everything else about us is part genetic, part environment. Do, of course, consider devoting your smarts to important things, perhaps first and most important. It does make me sad when I see smart people merely do things like become... I was reading an article today on Quora about being a day trader. Is it a good idea? Somebody was asking. What a waste of intelligence. Does absolutely nothing for the world. It's very cognitively and emotionally difficult. Do consider devoting whatever smarts you do have, especially if you've got, you're quite intelligent, to important things. But, okay, back to this catch-22 question. If you are a bright person in the workplace, how do you avoid that catch-22 between, on the one hand, if you demonstrate and use your intelligence all the time, you're at risk of getting me seen as, he's a know-it-all, he's so full of himself. On the other hand, if you pull your punches, you're not being the best you could be, what a shame. Well, the best answer, really, is to avoid the problem. And you do that by spending as much time as possible around people at least as smart as you are. And by the way, don't tell me about emotional, about multiple intelligences. I understand that that's a very comforting concept, but the real good, unbiased research shows that that this basic thing called intelligence, that is the ability to learn, memorize, abstract, analyze, synthesize, really is a dominant, maybe certainly the most important kind of intellectual capability, at least in Western society. You know, I suppose if we're in a very primitive society, it may not be so important. But if we're going to be living in a quote, progressive society, an advanced society, it's an extremely important that ability to reason, to learn, to memorize, to analyze, to synthesize. So do spend as much time as possible on people at least as intelligent as you. When you're interviewing for a job, check the employer out. You normally, in today's job interviews, you interview with a lot of people. Check them out as much as they're checking you out. There's such a temptation. We're so nervous about, even no matter how bright we are, there's a temptation in the interview to feel like we're just on display. We're we're to be judged. We're not to judge, but judge them as much as they're judging you. Not, of course, just on intelligence, but certainly make an assessment of how bright these people are. Are you going to fit in? Are you going to feel like you have to hold yourself back? By insisting you be among your intellectual peers, not only will you avoid having to shut yourself up lest you appear to be a know-it-all, you will grow more yourself. And you and your work group's work product will be better. And that matters. It benefits customers. That's people. That's you. That's me. And it benefits the larger society. Taking a progressive issue, if you're working for a nonprofit, an anti-war, say, nonprofit, a pro-peace nonprofit, being around other really smart people enables you to be synergistically intelligent and come up with better peace solutions than if you insist on working in a place where there are some, let's say, crayons that aren't the sharpest in the box. Also, if you are more of a solo operator, somebody who doesn't work well in teams, and because there are relatively few jobs where you are in this hothouse, this greenhouse of really bright people. Not everybody can work at a think tank or at a top university or in a corporation that gets the very best and brightest. And especially if by personality you're just not cut out to work on teams, realize that working alone may yield more benefit than collaborating with lesser lights, where as you're trapped in that catch-22. As doing part of the research for this show, I found an interesting quote. It was on Quora by Richard Muller. He is an eminent Berkeley physicist professor. And he was asked this question. He was asked, how do you feel when someone is better than you, smarter than you? Here was his answer, word for word. I'm going to read it. He said, remember, this is an eminent Berkeley physics professor. He says, I feel intimidated. I feel stupid. I feel embarrassed. I feel uncomfortable. I approached Luis Alvarez to be my supervisor for my PhD work. At the time, it seemed that everyone in the physics department at Berkeley considered him the smartest person they had ever known. Years later, Richard Feynman, as a legendary physicist, told me the same thing about Alvarez. So most of my time with Alvarez was one of awe and a strong feeling of inferiority. I consoled myself that even if I eventually learned just a little of what he knew, what he could do, it would be an enormously valuable education. One day, I recall putting my hand to my head and pretending to turn a key. I called it my ego key, and I had to turn it off in order to keep working with Alvarez. Forget ego. Just learn everything I could possibly learn. I remember when I joined Jason, which Alvarez nominated him. Jason, by the way, is a group of elite scientists that advise the United States government on matters of science technology, mostly very sensitive stuff about war, weapons, peace, all that stuff. And I'm continuing to quote, still from Richard Mueller. He says, I found myself working with dozens of people every day during the summer, all of whom were really vastly smarter than I was. They include Freeman Dyson, who was, by the way, a guest on this radio show. I was privileged to have him. Dick Garwin, Steve Weinberg, Mal Rudiman, Walter Monk. Continuing to quote from Richard Mueller, I remember the stress that being surrounded by such smart people triggered in me. But I took solace that I was in the most stimulating learning environment I could imagine. I knew it would be tough, but if I could survive, I would emerge as a much better scientist. I did survive. I later learned that it was a member of that Jason group who nominated me for my MacArthur Prize. That's the Genius Fellowship, which you only get for having made a major contribution. Continuing to quote him almost at the end, it says, in my mind, every one of the other Jasons qualified for that prize. I was somewhat awestruck to discover that any of the other Jasons actually considered me to be smart. So, that's my major, one of my points here. We think of intelligence as this wonderful thing, but it is a burden, especially when a person chooses, who's bright, who chooses to be around other really smart people, which is intimidating and scary, but knows that he or she will grow more and therefore contribute more. So I'm asking you, if you're not the sharpest tool in the shed, to feel, instead of this natural tendency that we have to try to cut down those who are smarter than us because it makes us feel inferior, to realize that they have burdens, to engender, to give to them the level of sympathy that you might give to somebody who is not so bright, who might have a problem, because it's a challenge. Okay. But not every bright person is going to be working with bright people all the time. Now what? While your cognitive intelligence, that is your ability to reason, to abstract, to analyze, synthesize, is correlated with emotional intelligence, that correlation is far from perfect. Use that cognitive intelligence of yours to try to parse out what it really takes to influence people. People who are not necessarily intellectual powerhouses. And if you wish, and most people do, to get those people to like you, and not think of you as a blowhard know-it-all. What really are your barriers to connection with regular folk? Is it braggadocio? Do you tend to show off unnecessarily? Do you have a substance abuse problem? There are plenty of people who are very bright who still have a substance abuse problem, which can absolutely affect not only your intellectual ability to function, but your ability to get along with people. Do you demonstrate intolerance of the less intelligent? Some of it is not to your credit. Yes, some of your intelligence came from the environment, from your working hard, from being willing to hang around smart people, even though it makes you intimidated. But some of it is genetic. You need to feel a sense of gratitude. That is where the privilege part comes in. And therefore, you should feel more, if not only more than tolerant, more gratitude when you're working with somebody less intelligent instead of being so frustrated so fast. And I'm not saying we all can. We all have gotten frustrated with a store clerk who just doesn't seem to get it. Charles Darwin wrote, quote, "Ignorance more frequently begets confidence than does knowledge." In short, ignorance is bliss. So that requires bright people to pull on ropes of restraint. And that is another of those burdens of the intelligence. To realize that sometimes you're going to be metaphorically or literally rolling your eyes, or certainly tempted to, in meetings when the comments are generally, by definition, if you're really quite bright, they're not going to be as bright. And having, especially if you have an impatient personality, to have the restraint to realize you will pay a big price if you are demonstrating judgmentalness like that. You internally, you probably shouldn't avoid it. You want, judgmentalness is a good quality. It is discernment, reasoning, separating good ideas from bad ones. But demonstrating that unnecessarily is unnecessarily putting people down. Now, that's where you've got to decide, is it worth the benefit to the project, to society, to the employer, to your own employment, to bring up your disagreement? And that is what's really important, is deciding when to bring up an idea, when in balance. Use that intelligence of yours to essentially perform a calculus. When do you reach the sweet spot of how often to speak up with your intelligent idea, and yet not so much that you incur too many of the liabilities? And of course, and I've said this ad nauseum on the show, but it also is a matter of couching. If you have this good idea, it's normally wise to couch it in a way that is face-saving. So I can understand your point, and I'm wondering if X is a good idea. What do you think? So by acknowledging their point, paraphrasing what they've said so they feel heard, and avoiding the word but saying and, which I know it's a technique and it bothers me even saying it, but we're human, and so humans need to have self-esteem normally preserved. Yes, there's the occasional time you do need to shake somebody from their equilibrium when they think they're so much smarter than they are and they're ruining things for everybody else. But generally, you want to allow them to save face. And that couching does that. Saying, so you're saying that blah, 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 so they've heard. And you don't want to say but, you say and. And then you say, I'm wondering, rather than I'm sure this or this is a better idea, I'm wondering if X is a good idea. Don't say better idea, a good idea. And then ending with, what do you think? Now, I am well aware that what I am asking you to do is something that I normally don't have the restraint to do. So I will fully cop to the fact that I am establishing merely a goal to strive toward, and fully acknowledge that it is not so easy to implement. And please, another thing that bright people need to do is, because everybody has always told them how bright they are, how much of the potential they have, you're going to screw up. Forgive yourself. You know, even the brightest person is going to make mistakes, either because they're just normal mistakes that every bright person makes. Sometimes we're all not at our best. Sometimes a really smart person can just be off that day, be exhausted, be distracted by a personal emotional issue. We're not just our brain. Even the smartest person has feelings. I have a client who's a Mensen, a very smart woman, an engineer. And her boyfriend just broke up with her. And we've had a session and she's extended emails to me. Believe me, not all of her statements are very smart. But I made a choice, of course, to not confront her about that at that time at all. And I probably never will. But the point is, we don't all function as intelligently as our potential allows us to. We're human beings. We're not computers. That's unfortunately why computers are replacing us so often, because they don't have bad moods. They're always operating at their best efficiency. Another tip, and I'm going to go to the phones. I definitely want to be turning to you in a moment, but I want to get closure on this. Intelligent people are aware of their high ability. So they tend to rely too much on their own judgment. No matter how intelligent a person is, obtaining others' input often leads to better decisions. I mean, that's why I would, no matter how bright the person reading an Encyclopedia Britannica entry, I would much rather read a Wikipedia entry because it's crowdsourced, even if not all the people are brilliant. So those intelligent people who think they're so smart, and they are, but they end up making more bad decisions than someone who's less intelligent, who's aware of his or her limitations. So even if you believe your coworkers aren't as intelligent or knowledgeable as you are, they could still likely add value to your own ideas. And of course, you needn't necessarily accept their input as, oh, I'm going to do that. But just consider it. All right, I think this is as good a time as any to go to the phones. So if you are a bright person in the workplace and you're struggling with that, or you want to agree or disagree or amplify with those ideas that I've shared about the burdens of intelligence in the workplace, or you're not such a bright person and you want to talk about or ask about how to deal with a brighter person in the workplace, those are all good reasons to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to kind of punctuate or highlight one of the points I briefly alluded to just a moment ago. Is that intelligent people really do have to live with the burden that they're expected to always be intelligent. But as I said, even smart people are not always on. And then, like anyone else, they're likely to be mistake prone. But they, and this is the important point, this is the add-on I want to give now, they and others are particularly hard on themselves because of the disparity between their usual functioning and their error. Please do give yourself a break. Literally and figuratively, by the way. Don't, you know, work, I work a lot, but, you know, anyway, it doesn't matter about, this is not about me. I do know some very smart people who enjoy spending some time doing mindless things. From hiking in nature, to perusing mail order catalogs, to watching dumb TV shows. Give yourself the freedom to do that. And, again, forgive yourself when, like everyone else, you say or do something stupid. Anyway, that's my brain dump about the burdens of intelligence in the workplace. I'll give out the phone number again for either of two reasons. If you want to comment about the burdens of being intelligent, especially in the workplace, or around working with super smart people, or any kind of problem. One of the things I like to focus on in the show is to do what I call workovers. If you or someone you care about is struggling with your work life, whether you're 16 or 76, an academic superstar, or somebody who's just struggling to get by, a practical superstar, long on common sense, short on degrees, whether you're unemployed or well-employed, self-employed, working for a nonprofit, for-profit, or government agency, I usually can help. All the common denominator, the only thing that's required is you got a problem. So if you got a work-related problem, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, last week I devoted the show to career decisions after age 50, and I didn't have time to talk about the retirement option. I talked a lot about ways to make the most of your work life when you're in your 50s or 60s or even 70s, but I didn't talk about if you decide to retire. There is a point where all of us, at some age, feel like we're, quote, done, that we're ready to take a step back and leave the workforce. And so, of course, with the newfound time, the person has some time to perhaps scratch a long-foregone creative itch, desire to volunteer, or to create relationships, strengthen their existing relationships. I wanted to share a few of these retirement and semi-retirement activities that many people find rewarding. Of course, one size does not fit all. Writing a blog, maybe with video, maybe it's your memoir, maybe it's short stories, maybe it's the great American novel or a nonfiction book. Mentoring young people. For example, students from your alma mater who this upcoming generation is going to have a harder time finding good work that's sustainable. And they could use all the mentorship. I mean, we all could have used them when we were younger. But this is your chance. mentor somebody from your alma mater, or volunteer for SCORE if you've been an executive or a business person of some sort. SCORE is a government agency that helps would-be entrepreneurs. I really think that mentoring is extremely rewarding for both, and so that's something that you may have time to do now. And it's very Eric Erickson, the famous psychologist, social psychologist, talked about seven stages of people's lives, and the live one we're in our 60s and 70s is I think it's called transgenerativity, passing on to the next generation what we know. So that's a really good retirement activity. Another is older people actually have a huge advantage in friend-raising or fundraising, because if you've got a lot, most people have not made a lot of money when they're young. They've made money over their lifetime, and finally, if they're at a point when they have some discretionary income of some size, and they're ready to potentially give, they're more likely to give to where if the pitcher, if you will, the pitcher for the nonprofit is somebody who's older themselves rather than somebody who's 25. So that's one of those activities where your age can be a plus. So think about your favorite charity or three and be a friend-raiser or fundraiser for them. And then similarly, one of those activities you might want to do for your nonprofit would be to join the board of a local nonprofit. That can be very rewarding. Decision-making, again, use that intelligence of yours to make a bigger difference, to really leverage the dollars that come in. Got a couple more, and then I'll get off this one. Sometimes when you retire, you want to run a simple small business so you have control over your life instead of being this pawn, this marionette in this corporate, nonprofit, or government structure. You know, maybe you want to buy and sell collectibles on eBay, postage stamps or whatever. I collected stamps as a kid. Maybe you want to make or sell jewelry on Etsy. You know, and if it's not really, it needs to be a big money maker, you've now got a lot of control. You got creative control, you have financial control. And that can be a very rewarding retirement or pre-retirement career. Take a photography course, an arts person, so any course. And it's a great opportunity to learn. The Osher Center at UC Berkeley Extension, UC Berkeley, provides lots of courses for older people. Adult schools provide courses for older adults. Extension, San Francisco State Extension, UC Berkeley Extension. Take a course in whatever. I kind of jumped on this photography thing because there's so many people who feel artistic but aren't great at drawing or painting or whatever. Photography requires less of that artistic talent and more of just a visual aesthetic sense. And then specialize in something. Decide you're going to take naturalistic portraits of children rather than posed ones, or the realities of the urban landscape rather than the too antiseptic landscapes we too often see. Or learn something about post-production photography where you create surreal photographs. Pick a niche so you feel you've got an identity. One of my personal favorites, get involved in community theater. As an actor, and you don't have to be an actor, you could be a set designer or a costumer or an usher or run lights and sound as somebody who's directed plays. Let me tell you, it's hard to find a good person who's willing to show up to every performance to run the lights and sound. Community theaters often really welcome such volunteers, and nobody's going to be prejudiced against you because you got some wrinkles and gray hair. And finally, spending extended time with current or past friends. Maybe just on an ongoing basis, a little one-time getaway, go to a ball game or whatever. But maybe, one of those once-in-a-lifetime things, a getaway to some beautiful nature spot at Yosemite or Grand Canyon, and where all your friends, maybe from all around, maybe you went to school at some other part of the country or separated from friends, agree you're going to meet in Colorado to spend a weekend together in a cabin. Those are the kind of things that people don't often have time to do. I mean, nobody who's honest can say that the silver years are golden, but there can be silver linings. Anyway, I didn't want to end my last week's show about what career decisions after 50 without at least talking about some interesting things that can be done in retirement. But now, back to you, my dear listeners. Phone number, if you have a work-related problem of any sort, especially if you've got a comment about being a brighter person in a workplace where maybe you feel like not everybody is so bright and the challenges you're facing, for a regular workover or one specifically about that issue, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello? Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Marty. thanks so much. You know, I love your shows, and I would love to comment on every single one. But I do have a problem that I'm hoping it's okay to address today with you.
Please.
It relates to the past, actually, where you gave me some really great advice. And that was a show a while back where I asked you what to do about my daughter, who graduated college with a degree in PR, loves what she does, got a job in a company in entertainment, and they have treated her rottenly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not given her enough money and treated her just terribly. And mm-hmm. you and your wife both said, just get out. Mm-hmm. They're never going to change, just get out. Mm-hmm. So it's taken me months to convince her, mm-hmm. but she finally started sending out resumes, contacting all, she knows a lot of people. Mm. She doesn't want to stay in entertainment. She doesn't care where her PR skills can be used. Mm. She just wants to do PR, social media, coordinating, that kind of thing. And in the meantime, they did give her a promotion, a small one. Mm-hmm. So she is now called a media coordinator, not an assistant. Mm-hmm. She's finding it almost impossible to find a job. And it's ironic because she got this job right out of college with no problem. So I just would love to know what else I can do to help her. She's getting very, very depressed. The more time she spends with this job, the more her spirits are going down the drain. And I just really want to help her get out. She's convinced that she has to get a new job before she leaves this one because she doesn't feel it looks good to have a gap in her resume. Well, so any advice you can give would be helpful.
Yeah, a couple things. You know, while it is true it is better to look for a job when you have a job, it's not a deal killer. But I think let's have her stay. But you certainly said that she knows lots of people, and as cliched and as often as I've said it is, you know, roughly between 20% and 80% of all jobs are gotten from people who know somebody. And
right.
They may not have something for you that moment, but what really is required is to systematically make a list of the 20 or 30 or 50 people who she knows who likes her. Not necessarily people who can hire. Most people can't hire her. But simply say, hey, I'm really good at PR coordination. Let her list the three things. Three is usually the magic number. Here are the three things I do well. I've been doing it in entertainment, but I'm open to a PR in other areas. I'm really doing fine on the job. They've actually given me a promotion, but my pay is terrible, and they're making me work do unbelievably long hours or whatever it is, so that they don't feel like she's looking for a job because she's a loser, but rather
right.
because the employer's treated her badly. And then what's going to happen is she reaches out to these 20 or 30 people, either, and it's going to be individual. Some she's going to just email, some she's going to get together for coffee, some she's going to go hiking with, some she's going to do whatever. And they're all 90% or all of them are going to say, I don't have anything. But the beauty is that when you say to them afterwards, I understand, would you mind keeping your ears open? The odds
are...
Believe
it or not, she's done all of that already. And she's gotten interviews. She gets to the second fourth stage of the interview.
That's another story.
She really wants. She's got an in, somebody on the inside who's pushing for her. She gets such enthusiasm over her skills, her resume, her reasons for leaving. And she can't seem to,
got
what
it.
They call
okay.
sales, close the deal.
Then there's two things. That's two. Then her problem is the interviewer references. Because if she's done all that, which I'm glad, and it's worked for her, but she's getting in the second interviews and not getting the job, it's either A, her interviews skills aren't that good, B, she, upon good probing questioning, they see she's not really very good, or C, her references are sabotaging her. Is it possible she's not as good? You're her mom, so it's hard to be objective about your own kid. But is it possible she's not that good a coordinator? And when some people probe her resume and say, well, tell me more about what you did when you say you saved the company $9 zillion by you know, organizing this or whatever, tell me more about that.
And I'll tell you, Marty, I mean, I would say, yes, you're right, I'm the mom, so of course I'm going to think she's great. But I actually illicitly listened in on one of her interviews that was over the phone, and she is phenomenal with her interviewing skills. So I can't think that it's that. I mean, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I would hire this person. The minute she's just every detail about what she's done for the company, everything that's happened in her department, all the people she's represented it for PR and what they've gone on to do, she's phenomenal, and they all love her, and they all say so. And one company has been stringing her along for 4 months now, saying, you're the one we're going to hire. We're just trying to solve some internal problems. It's that kind of thing. And
okay.
She just doesn't understand what's holding up the final the final offer with, you know, a number of companies.
Then there's so, there's two possibilities. Again, now we keep moving this thing forward, which is fine. So one is that indeed, you know, because you know they're treating her badly at her current job, it's possible that they've gone and checked her references, and whether she, you know, she may not list her boss or whatever, but if they contact the boss and the boss says some bad things about her, that could be the kibosh. And the other thing is, sometimes you need to go the extra mile to, after the interview, there was actually a book called Through the Brick Wall that was written a number of years ago that says that jobs are won and lost after the interview. So that, for example, if she just wrote some stupid thank you note, that's going to hurt her, because smarter job seekers do far more than write a thank you note.
Oh, I help her with them. Believe me, they are thorough and they're wonderful.
Okay, so if you
think... I'm a writer and I listen to every show of yours, so I got all the tips to pass on.
Okay.
Yeah, and we Google good follow-up letters. I mean, she spends hours on these follow-up letters.
Okay.
So it can't be that.
Okay,
it's something else.
Let me go somewhere else. So is it that her bosses are putting the kibosh on her in references, or more positive thing is some job seekers... After the interview, because now after the interviewing process, they know pretty damn well what it is the employer really wants, well beyond what's in the job description. And so the successful job seeker calls her friends who might ideally know that employer, or at least simply is credible as a person who's got some gravitas. And that person emails or phones the employer and says, you know, I hear that Mary Johnson is applying for a job as coordinator at whatever. And I just want to throw my two cents in there because she is really awesome at X and Y, those X and Y being the things that are really important on that job. Sometimes that kind of a reach out can make all the difference. Or if she's worried about if her boss is screwing her on the references, should she have a candid conversation with the boss about... I know she's not going to want to admit that she's looking for another job, but doing more to get in her boss's good graces, either so that she gets treated better there, or at least when it came time for a reference that boss will give her a good reference.
If she's several companies have expressed interest and have just been kind of stringing her along. Is there anything she can do besides out and out pressuring them every week? Is there any way she can, like, make something happen when they keep telling her they want her, they're just waiting for the position to open up, or something like that?
No, I think that gets to be too pushy. I think that gets to be too desperate and not good. We live in an America in which the hiring process has extended immensely. And I, frankly, because of various, I don't want to get into detail. So many considerations have extended the job, the hiring process for months. It used to be, when I first started as a career counselor, it was one interview. Then it was two. Now there's three and four. Then there's very detailed background checks. Then there is, of course, as always, is the funding been released? And they're very, very scared to hire on a full-time basis because they're so afraid of wrongful termination suits that they go the extra mile. And there are just other considerations other than merit that are involved. It's hiring is very different than it used to be for a variety of reasons.
So would you recommend that I see if there's some kind of a job counselor she can talk to, or a headhunter, or somebody like you who will help her with this process? Because I'm just seeing her emotional state just getting so bad.
You're successfully involved, and it's not, I don't mean to be turning away business, but I think that maybe from what you're saying, it's smarter for her to expand her search, expand or contract. So, for example, if, let's say, there may be certain verticals, I'm going to talk about contracting it. She doesn't want to do entertainment anymore, but there are certainly certain areas of our society that are growing enormously, and that, of course, is healthcare, that is government, and also diversity. And so working for organizations that work in those spaces, in the organizations, nonprofits or for-profits that are involved in healthcare or diversity or working for a government agency, by focusing on that, she ends up gaining more expertise in that. So, for example, if I, for example, were Kaiser Permanente and I'm looking for somebody to join my staff as a coordinator in my PR department, I'm going to be much more likely to hire somebody who has a lot of healthcare experience. So if she focuses on that and really starts to read, maybe take courses in PR specifically for healthcare, then when she applies, that may put her over the hump. And as I said, again, having people call on her behalf can push her through the brick wall. So that's
you always talk about the glamorous fields and the not so glamorous ones, which is where there's actually usually a better chance of getting a job.
Correct.
So, and she's been applying to tech companies and media, social media companies, because that attracts her. But would you put those on the bottom of the list for?
No, not
for
bottom. That's such a growing area that in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, I wouldn't put it on the bottom. But I mean, sometimes when people are having a hard time, sometimes you go to the grunge. So, for example, let's say. Uh-huh. I'm just making this up. But let's say you're a plumber, you, and that you know a lot about the plumbing industry. That's clearly not sexy. There aren't a lot of people who want to do PR for plumbing companies or marketing communication for plumbing companies. But you may know a lot about it. You may have taught her a lot about it. You may have connections and ins. So the competition is less fierce. That's at kind of the bottom. There are some people who are working for, I have a client now who works in sanitation, who works for the public agencies that clean the crap out of the cisterns or whatever they're called. Sanitation districts. There's nothing more low level than that. I'm not saying she needs to do that, but the point is, at the height of sexiness is entertainment, is media, is sports, uh-huh. is fashion. In the middle yeah. is your kind of generic stuff, working for Safeway, working for a transportation company, working, and then at the bottom of the prestige level are these kind of grungy companies. So that can sometimes be a way to get hired. I had a client who was happy to work in scrap metal. literally, in the scrap metal industry, it happened. His uncle or whatever was in that industry. And in the end, what he was, I don't remember what he was a sales guy or a project manager or whatever he was. But that enabled him to get hired in much more quickly, because nobody wants to work in scrap metal.
Okay. So you're saying she should put her energy and whatever resources she has towards looking at different kinds of fields that might not be so sexy, as opposed to trying to get more personal help. Although I don't think it's possible to get personal help anymore. I mean, when I look up job, like headhunters and stuff, when I look it up, it's all online. In my day, I actually could talk to somebody like you, and they would actually help me with the whole process. But I don't think that happens anymore. I mean, you would know because you are one. So. Yeah.
Headhunters are very different. Headhunters are people hired by a company to steal the best employees from their competitor.
And that wouldn't be her level, right?
Right. Generally, they're not. Now, there are headhunters that work in temp. There are temp agencies that are a version of headhunters. That has she tried as a way of getting out? And occasionally this works. But I can't say always. But there are temp agencies that...
I made that suggestion last week. I said, why don't you just do a transitional thing with a temp agency? She hadn't thought of that, so she's thinking that over as a possibility.
Yeah,
instead of just quitting and waitressing while she looks,
And increasingly, there are, as I said, employers are terrified of hiring people full-time because it's so hard to get rid of somebody if they turn out to not work well. So there's ever more companies hiring temp merely just to avoid paying benefits. But sometimes...
Yeah.
But sometimes as a stepping stone. So
okay, I'm going to push that one with her a little bit then, because I think that is a possibility.
And then once she's there, again during the interview process, they normally treat temps like crap. So so she's got to really check them out during the interview process as well as they're being checked out. And then if it's a good company and she's working even on day one, she gets hired as a temp. To let it be known to the higher-ups that her real dream would be to work full-time with benefits, and what can I do to make myself indispensable, and, doing all that kind of stuff. So that way she at least increases her chances of going from temp to something that isn't running around from project to project every 2 months.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Oh, well, this is all such good advice. Thank you so much, Marty, for spending all this time with me. I really appreciate
and
it.
And don't forget about that idea about having somebody call on her behalf. After she's right. had that interview, you may have helped her craft this perfect letter, but...
she does have these people on the inside already, friends, who work for these companies, who are already putting in word for her, saying, you know, you won't be sorry. She's great. We've known her for a long time. You know, we worked with her at the other company. And that's not even doing the job. That's not even helping. Yeah. I mean, it should be helping, but it's not.
It's sounding like there's something going on. And don't ignore that possibility that, in fact, if she's done well in the interviews, she's got all these insiders, and she's still not getting the job.
Maybe the bosses are... Yeah.
Yep. And so, you know, she may need to make nice to have a very subtle conversation with that boss to try to at least neutralize the antipathy. Because if the boss,
I don't know how she could do that without letting on that she's looking.
She doesn't have to do it that way. She could do it, say, you know, let's say her boss's name is Mary. Mary, you know, I've gotten a sense, you know, that even though I'm doing a good job, and by all accounts I'm doing, you're giving me a promotion, there is a sense that something is not quite right. Can you talk to me candidly about what's going on now? Even if they're really Simon Legree, horrible company, treating you like crap, but just simply coming to that way in a way that makes the boss not feel defensive could neutralize their antipathy. She doesn't have to say, hey, I'm looking for another job. Would you give me a good reference? No. But just saying, hey, you're getting the point.
Should she go to the top boss? Or should she go to her own immediate supervisor?
I would think that her own immediate supervisor is the one most likely to be giving the recommendation that goes beyond, yes, this, she worked here from this date to this date or whatever. You know, sometimes they don't, and sometimes corporate policies, they don't say anything. But very often an employer can, even with tone of voice, make very clear that the person is not good. So it's from what you described, she sounds like God, the goddess in both the interview process, the qualifications. So there's something missing. There's something wrong. And this could be, you know, mom bias that's going on here. But there's something else going on. And so right now, the most logical thing is that the boss is sabotaging.
Thank you. You know, I've just been searching for that, you know, thing that I couldn't put my finger on. And that could very well be. So I'll try seeing if she's brave enough to go that route.
Okay.
And meanwhile, we'll take all the other advice. And I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much, Marty.
Did the best I could. All right. You take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You certainly sound like a great mom, boy. You know, you're certainly devoted to your kid.
Well, I have a lot harder time deciding what I'm going to do with the rest of my life now that I'm in my, according to your show last week, which I listened to every word of, I'm in that group that is struggling to figure out what to do next. So, but first, I got to get her out of her depression. Otherwise, I can't think about myself. That's what moms are, right?
No, that's self-sacrificial. I don't think so. I think you know.
Okay.
The fact. Okay. No. The fact that that you really want to do something next. I mean, you have me on the phone. You sure you don't want to tell me about your situation?
Okay. I'm a teacher.
Yep.
And I want to stop teaching. I don't teach. I don't have really any benefits. So I really can't afford to retire, mm-hmm. but I am really kind of done with the pressure of teaching. It's not that I don't like teaching itself. I'm just kind of done with dealing with all the issues that come along with it. Mm-hmm. And I'd be happy getting into a brand new field. I don't need to make a lot of money. I just need to be able to pay my mortgage,
okay.
Which I've been doing as a teacher. As you know, it's one of the lowest paying jobs there are. So I've, you know, managed to get along this far in the Bay Area doing what I'm doing, and I can't imagine that I would be going downhill from here with any other job because it's pretty
I can't agree with that. I can't begin to agree with that. You know,
oh, really?
Teachers make 70, 80, 90,000, 100,000, and they have 180-day school, 172 work school year for students. They get benefits. They have lifetime job security. Teaching these days is one of the best paying of jobs for people who are not very technical. I can't go along with that at all. When you add everything, but let's talk a little bit about.
Yeah.
Do you want to? You know there are two kinds of people in your situation. You could want to do something radically different. So you could decide that you're going to want to leverage your network. Normally, if you're a newbie in your 50s or 60s, the employers in the you know
right.
coming in from advertised jobs not going to hire you. So you leverage your network into something very different. Let's say you have a friend who owns a boutique. you know, and she needs a manager for 3 days a week or whatever, and she's willing to give you benefits or whatever. That's one option. The other is the government option, because government is the least ageist. They're upset.
Oh.
They're very interested in hiring people of all, you know, ages, race, gender, sexual orientation, blah, 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 et cetera. So,
I thought it was really hard to get a job with the government.
It is. It's hard to get any job that's good, but certainly won't, you know, but there are jobs. So, and again, even in government, it helps if you know someone. So would you leverage your job? Like, there's a million, we have the most labyrinthine education bureaucracy imaginable. There is the school districts, there is the county, there is the states, there are SELPAs, there is foundations, there are for-profit companies, and of course, the feds. There's a zillion non-teaching jobs in education. Do you want to try to leverage your education background in some way to a government job, or use your network to try to get a job?
I could, but I'm 63. You don't think I'm too old to even be considered to be offered anything with any kind of benefits? I mean,
did you say 53?
No, 63.
Oh, 63. No, again, I would be a liar to say that it's easy. No, it's a minus, but it really is. I like this metaphor that there are baseball players who have one strike on them and hit a home run, and there are baseball players who even have two strikes on them and hit a home run. Your age is one or two strikes against you. It's not three. And in some jobs, your age is even a plus. Either, for example, the workplace culture is such, there are some workplaces that have a lot of older workers for whatever reason, and then you fit in better into that culture. Or there are some where the client base is older. So, for example, a program that some government agencies is doing elder education or whatever, you'd be a plus there. So I would keep my eyes open and say, of course, it's one strike against you, maybe two, or in some cases, none. But I certainly wouldn't give up on it before because you're 63.
If I don't have any networking possibilities in government, what kind of resources could I use to find what's out there?
There were in the old days, and maybe even still today, in the white pages, the front few pages of the white pages of your phone directory.
I don't even think I get one anymore.
Yeah, you can. I think it exists, and they still have the local government agencies and the state and the federal agencies all listed in one place. And that will you can just, there's about 8 pages of them, as we said. Government is huge, and some would say growing, some would say metastasizing. But looking through all of the agencies and saying, which one would leverage my own background, where it would be education and or age-related, and then Google those agencies and learn about them. And then because they're public, they often list who the leadership people are. And that can get you the name of somebody to write to. And then either just if you say, let's assume you have no network, so let's forget the network thing. But write, you're a writer, you say, and you write great letters. You give good letter.
So, yes, I do.
Right. So give good letter to people at, make your goal 5 or 10 of these agencies. And that would make you irresistible as a potential employer, but also say, I'm worried that I'm too old, but I'm still, if hopefully you are in reasonable health, and you still have, you sound very energetic.
Yeah,
you sound great.
I look and act like a 50-year-old. That's because I've been working with kids, and they keep me young. So.
Well, you sound it. You certainly will do well in, phone interviews, no question. So, write those great letters, follow up with great phone calls, and see, you don't need to narrow down too narrowly here. It's like putting the word out to in the right ballparks and seeing which ones of them feel, which ones yield something. That's my best shot.
Okay. All right, great. Well, that's a really good direction I had not even considered. So thank you. That's wonderful.
All right.
Thanks so much. And I promise to get back to you. You always say, please get back to me and let me know how things turn out when I give advice. So I'm going to do that too, if you don't mind.
I love that. That's really right, because it's very easy for me to give advice, but the proof is in the pudding. If it works, great. It'll help our listeners. If it doesn't work, it'll also show listeners what doesn't work. There'll be lessons to be learned. So, yes, I'd welcome your call back.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you so much, Marty. Really appreciate it.
You take care.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. I want to end. I've had an email exchange with one of my listeners, and he gave me permission to mention his name. His name is Scott Edelstein. And he wrote the following. I'm going to read you the little exchange. He wrote, a LinkedIn article about, it was called 10 Things You'll Hear in Almost Any Toxic Workplace. And he talked, in his letter, I'm editing here, he said one of the things that they're always saying, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And that is, I'm going to paraphrase, it's such garbage. So much of what is quality cannot be measured. To reduce it, it's like whether it be with school children, not everything can be reduced to a test score, but certainly as adults, how can you really always reduce to a measurable thing a clever idea? Not every clever idea is going to result in positive outcomes or bottom line profits or more. Not the ability to motivate other people to, even if it doesn't translate to the bottom line, if I'm a manager who manages to keep my employees satisfied and happy, and therefore not, even if it doesn't result in less turnover, which would be something that could theoretically be measurable, but creating a work life that improves the lives of those human beings and makes them feel good about coming to work every day should be counted. Now, yes, even some of that stuff can get measured. But if we insist on measure, then we're going to have to measure everything. Measure profits, measure employee satisfaction, measure turnover. Then we're spending too much time measuring. So I'm not convinced that measurement thing is so critical. Now, the other thing he said, which was really interesting, and this is what I wanted to focus on, I won't have time to read it all, and unlike last week, I'm not going to rush. He said he spent a lot of years as a manager in other countries. And here's what he said. This one was one he hadn't visited, but he said, I've not been to Japan, but I understand that an employee always answers yes to the manager who asks, can you do it? And that employee works to achieve assignments and sometimes dies right there at their desk trying to achieve. But in Japan, the manager, this is interesting, is responsible for assessing whether their employee has the capability and asks the right open-ended questions to make an accurate assessment. And then the manager takes credit or the blame for the team performance. Even today, I'm now continuing to read from Scott Edelstein's email. Even today, there's ritual suicide, stepping down publicly in shame when a team fails to perform. Owing to seriousness of outcomes, Japanese managers spend much of their time planning, which unfortunately often invites analysis paralysis because the stakes are so high. Because while we fail to plan most of the time, doing the try and try again routine, that's not so good either. He says that culture uses endurance to overcome obstacles, but Japan ends up being a pressure cooker. One more interesting one. I've been to Israel 4 times, he says. Within the tech sector, both in team planning sessions and meetings after execution of a plan, an employee is expected to criticize ideas, expected to criticize, and performance on the merits, no matter who says it, including the CEO. There is little deference to personal feelings or position, including the boss. If the manager or anyone did anything stupid or suggest something that's even flawed, it is your job in Israel to speak up. You will not get fired. To me, it feels brutal to attend such a meeting, but the result for Israeli techies is more effective and efficient work practice and better products and services. Israel is great for innovators and team players, but only if they have a very hard shell. And that is work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers and... What's it really like to be a soldier? I'll talk with Mary Roach. She's the author of Grunt, The Science of Humans at War. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.